So let's now look at the extensive answer from Avalokiteshvara regarding how to practice this wisdom of emptiness on the first two stages of the spiritual path. The brief answer was to see those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature, meaning not just the person, but the body and the mind, the basis of the person, the five aggregates. So when it comes to meditating, reflecting, meditating on the nature of reality, again, it's recommended to start with the person. But when you look into the texts, when they try to introduce the philosophical view of emptiness, they will normally use some physical object as the basis because it's easier to see when we're trying to develop the view of emptiness. So, you know, this Heart Sutra is coming from the second turning of the wheel, of course. This was clarified by great Indian master Nagarjuna, which is the basis of the Majjhimika philosophical system. And then I said we had those latter Indian masters, Buddha Palita, Bhavaveka, Chandrakirti. Particularly Buddha Palita and Chandrakirti were expanding on the Prasangika interpretation. And generally within Tibetan Buddhism, particularly in the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, when we study, when the emptiness, then usually they refer to this text from Chandrakirti as the basis of the discussions. And in that text by Chandrakirti, when he comes to present this view of emptiness and the reasoning we need to use, which we're going to talk about shortly, he uses as an example a chariot or a cart and sort of uses a methodical investigation to show that there's no inherently existing chariot or cart. So similarly here, we see in the first part of the answer, form is empty. So of course, form here is the first of the five aggregates. And in particular, if we relate the five aggregates to the person, then the form, of course, form is the body. So we'll have a look at this view of emptiness on the basis of what's being said here, the form aggregate or the body. Now we have four statements here. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. These four statements are often called what's called the fourfold profundity. So remember, profundity or profound, as we saw earlier in the Heart Sutra, the word profound is usually a name used for the wisdom side, you know, the profound path and the vast path. So the profound or the profundity here is talking about emptiness. So fourfold profundity means four statements about the profound, about emptiness, about the nature of reality. So the first of those is form is empty, and this is the profundity of the ultimate. Meaning the ultimate nature of form, or we can say the ultimate nature of all phenomena, but here, of course, we're talking about form. So what is the ultimate nature of form or the body? It is empty. But of course, when we see this statement, form is empty, we shouldn't interpret that as meaning, oh, then the body doesn't really exist because it's empty. When we see things like this, we need to ask, empty of what? What is the body empty of? And the form or the body is empty of independent existence or inherent existence. Here, of course, it uses the term inherent nature. But more commonly, The more common term you'll see is inherent existence. So form is empty of inherent existence. And so this term then, empty of inherent existence, this is emptiness. In Sanskrit, shunyata. And I think shunyata comes from the root shunya, which is actually zero, the number zero. And I think the mathematical term or number zero was developed or sort of invented, I don't know if that's the right word, but was, how would you say, coined and described actually from India. I think it was a great Indian mathematician who came up with this idea of zero. And that's shunya. And shunya sort of literally means like hollow. So it means like therefore empty. So it is actually a very good translation. And so again, when we see the word empty or emptiness, we need to understand empty of what? What is things empty of? And they're empty of inherent existence. So emptiness is describing how things don't exist, through, again, negating how they don't exist. Sometimes in the texts, rather than the word emptiness, shunyata, there are two other words sometimes used in the texts. You'll see them, suchness and thusness. They seem a bit awkward to me, but these are attempts to translate Sanskrit words relating to, or another Sanskrit word for emptiness. The first one, let me get this right here, suchness is tatvata. Which, sort of the way it's translated through the Tibetan at least, it means just that, nothing else. So it sort of means just that, nothing else. So it's another way of describing emptiness. Thusness is coming from the Sanskrit word tatata, and through the Tibetan that sort of is trans, it means like it is thus, hence thusness and suchness. But again, these are just variations, other terms you'll see for shunyata or emptiness. Just so that when you see that, you know what it really means. It's just another word for emptiness.
What about voidness? Is it still
used? Not really. Early on, when these terms came into the West, shunyata was often translated as voidness, but voidness sort of really does, on the surface, seem to mean like there's nothing there. So early on it was used, but I don't see really many translators anymore using that term. I only really see it in a lot, some of the early books that were written, you know, 20, 30 years ago. They seem to be one of the first terms, but it seems to have gone out of favor. And I think mainly because voidness really sort of means really there's nothing there, you know. Sorry? That's right, and I think that's why it's not really, I don't really see many modern day translators using that term, the term voidness. Rather, emptiness seems to be really the sort of the standard these days.
Because in French, we use the lacrité, which is voidness, which is not emptiness. So this is still used now, lacrité for emptiness.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. So that's fine. Yeah. Again, whether we use voidness or emptiness, I mean, you know, empty of what? What are things empty of? That's what we need to keep in mind. It's not meaning that, oh, they don't really exist. What we're saying is that they lack a certain way of existing. They're empty of a certain way of existing. That's what we need to keep in mind with this, whether we use emptiness or voidness.
And form is rupa? Yeah, form is rupa. Yeah. So remember in the five aggregates can be a presentation of all functional phenomena. In that way, form rupa means material world, the whole material world. Of course, body's part of that. But here I think the five aggregates, and more commonly within discussion of nature reality, when they talk about the five aggregates, they're more often talking about the basis of the person rather than all things, because this is where we need to focus when we're investigating reality more importantly. So here I think five aggregates form is really directing at the body, talking about the physical body.
In English, form sort of has two meanings. It can be the sort of the shape, the artistic nature of shape, or the material substance. Yeah. Is that contained in rupa as well? Or?
The etymology of rupa, I haven't really studied that. I wouldn't know. I'd have to look up what the word rupa really
means.
What's the etymology? And actually, I have an Indian friend who's very much a big Sanskrit scholar. He's studied many years. And even he says that, you know, it's hard to etymologize these terms because from his study, a lot of the etymologies of these Sanskrit terms has changed. So a lot of the modern day, you know, the Sanskrit scholars, modern day Sanskrit scholars, he says, say, well, the etymology of this is this. And he says, well, yeah, that's what's accepted now, but if you go back, in particularly at the time of the Buddhist things, it's not really that. So even there, we have to be a little bit careful when we see these etymologies of these words.
Yeah.
And, you know, he really has, I think, studied a lot in terms of Sanskrit, in terms of etymology, particularly within a Buddhist context. And he's a little bit critical of some of the modern day Sanskrit scholars because they're really using sort of etymologies that were sort of developed much later. So even there we have to be a little bit cautious when we see these etymologies of Sanskrit terms. And also, of course, the other thing is a lot of these Sanskrit terms are still existing in the modern Hindi language. And there, like any language, often words change in meaning over many centuries. So if we assume that this Sanskrit term that happens to be still used in Hindi has the same meaning as a Hindi term, then we can get a lot of confusion. Yeah. So we need to be also careful of that.
What do you say about the second one? The tathata?
Tathata.
Yeah. What is the term you use for that?
Thusness.
Just that, nothing else.
This one means it is thus. It is thus. It's like that. No. These are different terms for shunyata. Yeah. This means like, again, what do I say? It's just that and nothing else. And this is like, it's thus. It's like that.
So we can't say it is empty of suchness.
No. These are... No. Again, these are just sort of attempts to translate these terms from Sanskrit, which were used as other terms for shunyata. But again, you know, it's very difficult to translate these terms because in English there really is no word that has that same meaning. That's why these, when I see these words suchness, thusness, they feel a bit awkward to me. But I mean, if the term's there, the translator has to, you know, do something with it. And that's what sort of the attempt is. Okay. So then what we're saying is that the form or material things or the body is empty of inherent existence. In the Heart Sutra so far, we've seen the term inherent nature. What we're talking about here, of course, is emptiness, is nothing exists independently. There's no independent me, no independent objective world. So we're really negating this independent existence. And there are a number of other terms that are used in the texts, and so I'll just list those, the main ones, to get familiar with them. So again, the thing that emptiness is negating is that things are independently existent, so independent existence.
And again, probably the most common term that you will see is this inherent existence, which I think here in the text is translated as inherent nature. And inherent existence or inherent nature has the sort of idea that things have their own unique nature, that they are self-existent, that the world is divided up into many separate, discrete things. So that's the idea of inherent existence, inherent nature, or self-existence sometimes. There's another term used, that's quite common, you'll see, is things existing from their own side, or existing from its own side. And what this sort of has an implication is that that things have their own existence without depending on an observer, without an apprehender, that things simply exist from their own side. So that's another term that's commonly used. And then we have a third term which we came across just before. True existence. Normally the word true in English, something is true if it doesn't deceive us. Now, things appear to us to exist completely independent of us. If they were to exist in that way, they would be true. Meaning the way in which they appear and the way in which they exist match. That's what true existence means. True existence means existing in the same way in which it appears. So the cup appears to me to exist independent of me. If it in fact exists in that way, it would be true, meaning it's not deceiving us. It would have true existence. So again, true existence means existing in the same way in which it appears. So that's another way of talking about the same thing. So these probably are the three most common terms that you will see in the texts to describe independent existence. And here we have, so far, inherent nature, which is more or less the same word as this. So again, these three things are describing the same thing from a slightly different perspective. This is saying that things are self-existent, have their own unique nature. This is saying that things exist from their own side without the need of an observer. And this is saying that things are existing in the same way in which they appear. So these are probably the three most common terms that you will see in the texts. And of course, in our discussions here, and we're following the Prasangika school of Majjhimika, all of these terms mean the same thing. Whereas actually what we briefly saw just before, the Svatantrika, the Svatantrika would say that this and this term are not the same meaning. So they would say that independent existence means this and this, but they would not accept that. Because they would say that things really do have its own inherent existence. There is some sort of cupness there. But of course the Prasangika would tell the Svatantrika that this is not right, actually, that if things have their own inherent existence, inherent nature, that would mean that they would be truly existent, independently existent. So they sort of refute this idea from Svatantrika. So for our discussions, then independent existence is all of those same. Now, why is it a problem? Why is it a problem to see things in this way?
You know, it really does appear to us if there's a me here and a world there, independent of us. What's the problem in seeing the world in this way? What's the big deal? Because, of course, here we're saying that if we investigate, we'll come to see and realize that there is no independent me, independent world. But again, what's the problem with seeing and believing and accepting that there is in fact an independent me and independent world? What's the big deal with that? Why is that a problem? And so to answer that, we're going to look at, in your handout, just after the Mahayana path chart here, the suffering and its causes diagram. We're going to look at that now. And this is based also, we see at the top of that, there's a quote from Nagarjuna. So again, this is from his classic text, The Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, where he says, by extinguishing actions and mental afflictions, there is liberation. Actions and mental afflictions arise from misconceptions, and they arise from elaborations. Elaborations will cease through cultivating emptiness. So let's have a look at what that means, that what is Nagarjuna saying there. And that's this chart following here. And so here it's titled Suffering and Its Causes. Of course, the word suffering here is a translation of dukkha. So the first step of the process is what's called seed of ignorance. So again, here in the Majjhimika system, following the Heart Sutra, the ignorance that we are suffering from, the fundamental ignorance, is this grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. And seed of ignorance means the habit of doing that. The habit of believing in an independent me, independent world. And this is something, according to Buddhism, that we've had not just since the beginning of this life, but we've had it a lot longer before that. We basically inherited that at the beginning of this life, that we have this habit. Now, of course, when we look out on the world, things really do appear to us to exist independent of us. And remember, in the two lower philosophical schools, no problem with that at all. There is an independent objective world there. But this view, philosophical view from the system here, is saying that things are not existing in this way. Things are not existing as they appear to us. That these appearances are deceiving us. So this type of appearance that we're receiving in this system is called here, as we've seen here, mistaken dualistic appearance. And of course, mistaken dualistic appearance means there appears to be subject-object duality. There appears to be a me here and an independent world there. And it's mistaken because this view is saying that things are not existing in that way. But because things appear to us to exist in that way, and we have the habits of believing that, then we automatically accept appearances. We never question appearances. Because everything in our entire life has always appeared to us in this way. And if we ask anyone else, they'll say the same. Yes, that cup appears to exist independent of me. So there's no grounds or no reason for us to not accept these appearances. There's no reason for us to question these appearances because we've never experienced anything else. So we simply accept. Which is the second step, ignorance. So the second step is that we're simply, in our experiences, grasping on to independent me, independent world. Now, in every one of our experiences, we saw earlier that there were these mental factors we talked about. Some of those mental factors are there sometimes and sometimes not. You know, mental factors like anger and jealousy may or may not be present in the experience. But there were these five mental factors that are always present in every experience. And one of those five mental factors was the mental factor of feeling. And remember, feeling here is a translation of Sanskrit word vedana. And this mental factor of feeling is experiencing things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So let's say, for example, we are looking at this cup. This cup appears to exist independent of us. We have the habit of believing that. We don't question those appearances. We simply accept, yes, that cup is really existing independent of me. When I see that cup and experience that cup, mental factor of feeling is present. Let's say that I happen to be looking at that cup and experiencing that cup and I'm having a pleasant feeling when I see this cup. Then that pleasant feeling, together with the belief that that cup exists independently of me, will lead to the third step. Which is this misconception. Meaning, I'm having a pleasant feeling. This cup I believe to exist independent of me. Therefore, there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant feeling. So we'll see it as inherently attractive, that cup. Or if I'm having an unpleasant feeling when I see this cup, together with the belief that that cup exists independently of me, we will naturally assume, of course, there must be some unattractive quality there that's causing my unpleasant feeling. So we'll see this as inherently unattractive. Or, of course, if I'm having a neutral feeling, and a neutral feeling just means neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So I think probably most of us, when we look at that cup, our feeling experience is probably fairly neutral. And so, of course, then, if we're having that neutral feeling, then we'll believe that this is inherently neutral. There are neutral qualities there. So this is the misconception in third step. Once we have got to this point in seeing this cup as either inherently attractive or inherently unattractive based on our pleasant, unpleasant feeling, that easily leads to the fourth step. Because let's say again I'm having a pleasant feeling when I see this cup, And I'm believing that there is some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant feeling. Then, of course, I like pleasant feelings. I want pleasant feelings. That cup seems to be causing my pleasant feelings. I want that cup. Attachment. Or, if I'm having an unpleasant feeling, I don't like unpleasant feelings, I don't want unpleasant feelings, that cup seems to be causing my unpleasant feelings. Get it out of here fast. I don't like that. So that is aversion. Or if I'm having a neutral feeling, see, it's the pleasant, unpleasant feelings that really causes often a strong reaction in us, either grasping at something pleasant or pushing something unpleasant away. If it's a neutral feeling, it doesn't often cause such a strong reaction. But what it does is that we just reinforce our belief that this cup is existing independent of us. Every time we see it as inherently neutral, that's just reinforcing that this cup is really existing independent of us, which is ignorance, of course. But usually at this point here, instead of using the word ignorance, they use the word confusion. Of course, this word confusion here doesn't mean we're confused about whether or not this is a cup. What we're confused about is how does this cup exist? So, just a little aside, this word ignorance, this word ignorance in Sanskrit is anitya, and remember that was one of those three poisons. Ignorance, attachment, aversion. Sometimes in that presentation of the three poisons, instead of ignorance listed first, you'll see the word confusion, which has more or less the same meaning, and that's coming from the word moha. So in our discussion here, this word confusion and ignorance have the same meaning. So once we've got to step four, then these mental states are what's driving our behavior. Our actions. And of course, every action we do has a consequence. And the Buddhist theory is that every action we do with intention leads to a result. And those results are our experiences. And our experiences, of course, all of our experiences collectively were described by the Buddha using the word dukkha. So this is the process. So to relate that to Nagarjuna's quote, the quote from Nagarjuna's text, he says, by extinguishing actions and mental afflictions, there is liberation. So of course, we're stuck in dukkha now, this cycle of samsara. To get overcome that, we have to overcome the causes. What are the causes? Is our mental afflictions, and actions. So if we get rid of these actions, which are based on the mental afflictions, we can overcome dukkha, we can achieve liberation. And he says here, actions and mental afflictions. Well, here he's using mental afflictions as actually more specific. He's talking just about this, actually. Here he says, actions and mental afflictions arise from misconceptions. This misconception here. And he says, and they arise from elaborations. So this word elaboration is a term used for ignorance. So the word, you know, in English, to elaborate something means to sort of like build on it, to expand on it. And here, ignorance is sort of building on what's actually there. It's sort of making things more solid than they really are. So that's what the word elaboration is sort of indicating, is that ignorance is superimposing or elaborating a level of existence that's not there in the actual reality. And so sometimes we see the word superimposition, that ignorance is adding on to reality a level of existence that is not there. And in this case, of course, ignorance is, on top of reality, is putting this layer of existence, believing that things are actually independently existent. And it says here, elaborations will cease through cultivating emptiness. So by cultivating emptiness, we will overcome ignorance. So any questions about these six steps?
How do you extinguish actions?
By extinguishing mental afflictions. So actions here is karma. So karma is any action with intention, with mental affliction.
So it's contaminated action.
Yeah, that's implied. Yeah.
It sort of suggests all action.
Yeah, I mean here, of course, action for us is contaminated because we have ignorance.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, technically we could say contaminated action. Yes.
Yeah.
That's
so
right.
As an enlightened person, you still act.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have this contaminated action. Yeah, that's right. Correct.
If I replace them like a cup in a human being, what does Buddhism say about intuition?
Intuition. What do you mean by intuition in this context?
In like when you say that you are sometimes, that you are, when you see somebody, you always like think what like the consumption, the way your mind works, you know, like it makes me feel good, this makes me feel bad, I'm avoiding this, like natural about it. But what about the concept of intuition? Sometimes you just feel, you know, that this is not a...
Right. Now, here of course, we're talking about misconception. We're not really talking just about, you know, what we find pleasant and unpleasant. You know? So, the problem is not that we see things as pleasant or unpleasant. That's not the problem. The problem is this. So, intuition, I think what you're saying in this case is that sometimes intuition tells us that something's not right or right or pleasant or unpleasant without us really knowing what it is. Is that what you mean by intuition here?
Sometimes you get into, you know, see a person, or you get into a situation and you feel like...
Something's not right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Even before, you know...
Yeah.
I mean, you can think about maybe something that I don't know, saw in a movie, and it reminds me of this or this, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes it is. Yeah. I mean, there are cases that it is...
Yeah,
right.
So...
If you went away from that place and then... Something bad happened, but you went away because you felt that something is wrong.
Yeah.
So how could you,
So remember, with every experience as well, there's that mental factor of discrimination in every experience. And discrimination is to distinguish things. Mm-hmm. Not just that this is a person, but to distinguish also characteristics and so forth. And sometimes it's obvious how we do that, but sometimes based on our history and so forth, we have this intuition
about this person. So we're discriminating or we're seeing the person in a certain way, but we don't really know why we're somehow, this person is, seems to be a little bit negative or something. It's not obvious to us, but it's because that discrimination is happening at a very subtle level based on our probably history and preferences and so forth. And because our mind is not so clear, it's not so obvious to us that this is what's going on. So I think this is what you're saying. But again, what I'm saying is that it's, the problem is not so much whether we see things in a certain way or we see things as pleasant or unpleasant. The problem really lies from this, because that, together with this, leads to this problem. I mean, we can see, you know, if I have no ignorance, then I can still see this as pleasant or unpleasant based on my personal history or whatever, but it won't lead to me to react to that. Yeah. And one more point is on the intuition. Is we need to be very careful with that in terms of, from a Buddhist perspective, I think, of course, we can talk about genuine intuition. And I think genuine intuition is really a little bit our inner wisdom coming up without us really knowing, obviously, what the situation is. But then there's also this little sort of voice in our ear saying, oh, I think it's like this. And this is often our, if you want to use the word ego or self-cherishing mind, is trying to convince us that, no, this person is no good or this person is really good. So, and sometimes this sort of masquerades as intuition. So what would be suggested is not to blindly follow our intuition and say, well, it's my intuition, so I better act on it. Genuine intuition can usually be based on some sort of inner wisdom, but this false intuition is usually going to lead us completely astray. So we need to check that out a little bit. And often the way to check is, when we're having this intuition, is our mind very peaceful and calm, or is it a little bit agitated? If it's agitated, it's often this little voice telling us, you know, they're really bad, you know, don't go near them, or they're really good, go there, you know. So we need to be a little bit careful.
So going through this, he's like, it basically discourages you to make an effort in some way. Like, say, if I'm having this suffering and stuff, like I'm having this chart and I'm finding the cup attractive, and if it is falling down, I would like make an effort, I would jump and try to like have, like, see that it doesn't break.
Yeah, no problem with that.
But if I say, okay, I'll go through this idea that it doesn't inherently exist, the pleasant and unpleasant feelings are not inherently there, and if it is falling down, I'd be like, okay, it's falling down.
See, what's happening, and this is going to come up in the text shortly, is for us now, there's just two possibilities. Either there is some qualities there, or there's no qualities. So when we do look at this, this is negating or refuting that there are qualities inherent in the object. For us now, that implies no qualities at all. Doesn't it? I think this is what you're saying. So what's happening there is that we are flipping to the other extreme. Because for us, there's only two possibilities. Either there is some real quality there, or there's no quality at all. So this view, and this is Majjhimika, means middle way, is that we have to understand that this view of emptiness does not imply no qualities. Implies no inherent qualities. There is qualities. Like, for example, if we see this as attractive, is the beauty there? If the beauty was there, it would mean everyone who saw that object would have to see it as beautiful, if the quality is there. Well, unless, of course, you're blind, but anyone who would see correctly, normally, would have to see it as beautiful, because it's there. It's obvious, it's there.
But we know from our own experience that's not the case. And also in our modern language, don't we say things like beauty is in the eye of the beholder? This is the Buddhist view. There is beauty, but it's not inherent in the object. So there is beauty. So if you happen to see this as beautiful and it's yours and it's about to fall and break, you would stop it. You would catch it because you like that. It's beautiful. And the difference being, of course, is if we believe that the beauty is in the object, this leads to a lot of this. Because it seems like that cup is making me happy. So if someone tries to steal it from me, I'm going to get very upset with them. I'm going to get very angry with them. Or if my cup breaks, I'm going to be like distraught because, you know, I'm not going to be happy anymore. That's the result. Whereas if we understand that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, of course, you know, we would enjoy that cup, but if it breaks, we wouldn't get completely upset because we would understand that the happiness is not coming from the side of the object. But this is something very difficult. This appreciation that by negating the independent existence, the inherent qualities, to understand there is qualities, and not to fall to the extreme of nihilism, saying, well, nothing's there, so what do I care? This idea is very difficult. Because, again, for us now, there's just these two possibilities. Because we've never experienced anything other than that. Either things have qualities, they're real, the qualities are there, or if they're not there, then it really can't exist. We don't see a third possibility. This is the third possibility. But, again, it takes time.
Yeah, I'm just always thinking about this emptiness thing and then comparing it with the having or holding some objects as holy and the use of certain objects as a matter of or using them during the ceremonies and so on. So I find that so strange. To me, there's a conflict.
Yes, that's right. It appears like there's a conflict to us.
Yes.
Because we only see these two options.
Yes.
That's right, of course. And that's this view, as we're going to see. The view says, as a beginner, we will see functioning world and emptiness as contradictory. Exactly. That's why it's so difficult to understand. And that's why what we're going to do to help us to overcome this apparent contradiction is we're going to look at the flip side of emptiness in the second statement, emptiness is form, to help us to overcome that contradiction. How things do exist dependently. That can be helpful to overcome this apparent contradiction. Sure.
I'm a bit confused about confusion. It's very clear. Attachment. The cap, I am attached, I don't want to lend it to anyone. Aversion, I want to break it. But confusion, what is my behavior towards the cap?
Probably nothing dramatic. Again, it's these two that really lead to reactions. This directly probably won't lead to some heavy reaction, but what it will do, and this is confusion, it's just another word for ignorance, it just means that we are going to more and more believe that this cup is really existing there.
Reinforce.
Confusion is just another word for ignorance. So we're just reinforcing ignorance. It's not going to lead to reactions as the pleasant and unpleasant does. No.
It's more roots of ignorance.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So just going back to that. So basically, is this the right view? Like if the cup is about to fall down, I make an attempt to actually save it.
Because it's your cup and you need it to drink your cup of tea in the morning, and if it breaks, you won't have a cup to drink tea from, so it's...
Not like that. Like if it... So the action is without mental afflictions. If I'm...
Well, there'll be this mental affliction. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to catch the cup, you'll still be believing there's an independent cup falling there that I need to rescue. So there's still this operating.
Okay.
I mean, this and this may not be so operating.
Okay.
But this will still be there.
So that all the actions are, then you're saying all the actions are because of mental afflictions?
If you include ignorance, yes.
If I don't include ignorance, then I know, okay, the cup is falling down, it's about to break, and I understand it, all the inherent qualities are because of my mind. I just think, okay, you know what, I just need to save the cup.
Because it's useful to you.
It's useful to me. Or say, if it is an expensive cup, I take care of it, I store
exactly.
it in a safe. So those actions are without mental afflictions.
Mm. I mean,
and,
yeah. See, this attachment, I mean, in Buddhism, this cycle of existence we're in is often called the desire realm for a very good reason. Because the main driving motivation in our actions is attachment. Desire. So, yes, we can sort of save this and not have like this heavy attachment and so forth, but I think at a subtle level, there'll be still a little bit of somehow attachment operating there. I think at a subtle level, to do any action without any level of attachment is almost impossible, unless we get rid of ignorance. At our level, we can really reduce any very heavy coarse attachment, which will help us to overcome a lot of grief and despair when it breaks or someone steals it, you know. And that's where we need to operate at our level now as a beginner, is at least reduce very heavy mental afflictions, because they're creating a lot of suffering. And then the more subtle level of mental afflictions will slowly start to go away when we start to undermine the ignorance in that way. Yeah.
Simply implies sort of insecurity on the person's behalf that they're separate from happiness.
You mean ignorance causes insecurity?
Well, I was just wondering if it was a seed of ignorance or the dualistic thinking that there's always this, you know, neediness on.
Yeah, and from a Buddhist perspective, it's because of this.
That's ignorance, yeah.
That's ignorance. Because we sense, we believe we're separate from the world.
Yeah.
And then the happiness and suffering is coming from there. And so people who have, you know, this ignorance with respect to ourselves, of course, is called self-grasping, grasping onto this independent me. And this will cause that insecurity and fear and anxiety about the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you remove ignorance, you feel sort of whole or complete or... I don't know what it is.
Well, you wouldn't feel sort of
separate,
because I mean, this view is saying there is no separate me. But again, we're not saying that this means that we're all one big blob. Because again, for us, two things are either separate or the same. We don't see another possibility. So then if people think, oh, there's no separate me from the world, then we all become one. No. Example, a simple example, is this big?
That's it, yeah.
It's a small. So big and small are not separate. This is not big, this is not small. But are big and small one? Are they the same? No, they're still big and small. Isn't there?
Yeah.
But they exist relative.
Yeah.
So just because there's no separate big and separate small doesn't mean that they're one big blob.
Seed versus stain.
That's coming. I haven't got there yet.
And even the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, these reactions that are generated or triggers are also stains.
Stains.
I mean, somebody can find something pleasant or unpleasant based on past stains.
Well, stains. The way I'm going to use the word stain, we wouldn't use it in the same way here. I mean, we can say that we have certain habits, and they can be talked about as sort of seeds or imprints or whatever. But the way that I'm using stain, which I haven't done yet, is not sort of in that way. So
seeds is a bit of it.
Again, these are just concepts to help us to understand how things are working. So don't hold on to it, because, you know, seed, we think, oh, there must be this little round thing in my mind, you know. So you know, again, when we see these concepts, seed, imprints, stains, you know, we don't want to be sort of...
So there's a varying degree of prominence. Like, you know, seed is much stronger than a stain.
In this sense, no. Seed and stain lead to different types of results, as we're going to see. A seed is more like a habit, and a stain is not a habit. But we haven't, we're just, that's the next point. So maybe we go to that, but last question.
How would you incorporate the third cause of suffering here, hatred?
Hatred is a strong type of aversion. So aversion is this, is the sort of the base. It's this sort of pushing away. That can manifest in many different ways depending on the situation. It can manifest as irritation, as annoyance, as anger, as hatred, as resentment. All of these are sort of variations of the basic pushing away. That's why this is in the three poisons, is that this is the sort of the core element. Seeing something unpleasant, the instinctive reaction is to want to move away from it. And then, of course, depending on the situation, if it's a thing or a person and how strong the situation, that can escalate into just mild irritation or really rage, anger, hatred, annoyance. All of these are possible, depending on this. But they're coming from this initial pushing away. And actually, on that point, in those three poisons, normally it's listed ignorance, attachment, aversion. But sometimes in the three poisons presentation, here you'll see instead of aversion, anger. Because, and or hatred sometimes, because that's a very strong type of aversion that is very destructive. One we really need to pay attention to. So in the texts, they deliberately put it there to show to us that this is very harmful. But really what the poison is initially is just this pushing away. Okay, one more point and then we'll break for lunch. We've got one more thing in the chart. Is every time, of course, we have this ignorance, that reinforces the habit of believing that. So it's a sort of tight circle there. But also, every time we have that ignorance, that has a side effect, another effect. And that is what's here called the latency. Generally, the technical word you see in the text is latency of ignorance, but it's sort of like sometimes the word stain is used. Now, to understand what we mean by latency or stain here, often in the text they give a simple analogy. They say, imagine you've got a bowl and you have a clove of garlic, which is a little bit like the seed or the ignorance here. You put it in the bowl, even if you take it out, there's still the smell left over. The garlic stains the bowl with the smell. So like that, ignorance stains our mind. So it's a side effect of ignorance. So that's what it means by latency or stain. That ignorance stains our mind. What that stain does is that when we come into contact with an object, it appears to us to exist independent of us. So this stain is a little bit like a filter, meaning we're looking out on the world through this filter, through this stain. That's why everything appears to exist independent of us. That's why we receive this mistaken dualistic appearance. Because again, you could ask, if things do not exist in that way, why do they appear to us to exist like that? And the reason is because of this. That's why things appear to us to exist independent of us. That's the reason. So that's the last piece of the puzzle.
Coming to that explanation, like the garlic thing. So, I mean, it'll be the initial smell everything was about the initial sniff. There'll be a little bit of garlic, but when you focus or concentrate, that smell will not be the overpowering smell. So same here. Can we say...
You lost me now.
So can we say that, you know, because of this stain,
right,
the initial appearance will be a dualistic appearance.
Correct.
But then the more we challenge it, or the more we get used to the opposite of it, the stains actually of non-dualistic will get created in time.
Not quite. I mean, what we're going to see a little bit later in terms of our emptiness practice is, you're right, is that not only do we need to meditate on emptiness, but in daily life we need to do something as well. And what we need to do in daily life, or one thing, is not just automatically accept appearances, is to question appearances. But that questioning the appearances is not going to weaken the appearance. What it's going to do is, it's going to be very helpful down here.
But at least it will have some effect in the stables.
No, not really. I mean, not at that level. What it will do is, by questioning appearances, it'll help stop us from going down here and reacting. Because we'll notice the pleasant feeling or unpleasant feeling, but then we go, hang on, this thing is looking so attractive and so unattractive that it's appearing like that to me, but actually, where is that attractiveness in the object? You know, that's what we... And so, if you look here for the attractiveness by questioning these appearances, then you'll come to realize, well, actually, there's no attractiveness in the object. What's happening is, due to my pleasant experience and my past, past experiences, I am interpreting this configuration of colors and shapes as attractive because of my own past experiences. That's what we need to do. But that's not really going to weaken this. What it will do is weaken this and this.
That is more deep.
Yeah. More deep.
Like we learn to identify and then react.
Sorry?
We learn to identify, like to identify where it comes from.
Yeah, to investigate.
And then we won't react so much.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this. It's coming up.
But as humans, can we take up the latency state, or are they always there?
This is the next point, but it's time for lunch. Just to give you a brief answer, is remember in the Majjhimika system, like Chinamatra, we need to get rid of something to get to nirvana, but then something more to achieve enlightenment. So in this system we're looking at, what we need to overcome to get to nirvana, to overcome dukkha, of course we need to get back to here. If we get rid of this, we get overcome dukkha, we achieve nirvana. Ignorance. So we need to get rid of this, and to get rid of that, we realize emptiness. To get to enlightenment, we need to get rid of this. How do we get rid of this? Is by getting rid of this. That's what we need to further get rid of. This is very difficult to get rid of. So that's the last thing we get rid of. So to get from nirvana to enlightenment, we need to get rid of these subtle stains. That's what we see if we just turn to the objects of abandonment quickly, and then we go for lunch. Under cognitive obscurations, that's what's stopping from enlightenment. Right down the bottom, Prasanghika, it says, latencies of the conception of inherent existence, that's this, and all the factors of mistaken dualistic appearance that arise due to the force of that. So this is what we need to get rid of to get to enlightenment. But we're going to talk more about that after. So let's break now for lunch, and we'll come back at 2:00.